Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Allison in Wonderland Mental Health Podcast. We have a very special guest today, and hopefully we don't confuse everybody too much, but her name is also Allison. So this is absolutely an Allison in Wonderland episode where we are both going to kind of fall down the rabbit hole of some lived experience and talk about trauma and exactly kind of what our body and mind do when we experience trauma. But that's all Allison's part of this conversation. So I will pass it on to Allison and let her introduce herself.
Hey everyone, Allison as well. So yeah, again, I know this might be a little confusing. So I am a domestic abuse survivor. I actually died in 2017 for 33 seconds. I've been able to work through my trauma and have come out the other side. And I'm now a certified therapeutic art life coach and health coach. And so I specialize in helping women to really overcome their trauma, their negative self-beliefs, to build up their confidence, to overcome some fears and to ultimately build the life that they deserve. So I'm here to kind of talk through what trauma does in our brains and the patterns that we have in ourselves, and hopefully give you the steps that you need to start changing some of those negative beliefs.
Awesome. Thank you so much for the introduction. So, let's just kind of kick it off with, what is trauma? There are different types of trauma. And obviously, I mean, as a domestic abuse survivor who died for 33 seconds, I believe is what you had said, that's one kind of trauma, but there are other types of trauma. So what would you say are some of like the most common types of trauma that we deal with? And I say we as a whole, but I can tell you that the majority of the listeners are women, so it does sometimes get a little heavily weighted towards that.
Yeah, and trauma encompasses so many different things. And essentially, what trauma is an event that takes you out of your normal very quickly in a negative way. And so, trauma could be it could be physical abuse, it could be mental abuse, emotional abuse. Other traumas could also be like bullying, for example, is a huge one, and that's one that the whole United States is very focused on right now. Another trauma could be being laid off from work. That is one of those events where we tend to believe like the negatives of ourselves, and it's one of those things where we're constantly questioning, like, why was I laid off? Like, what led to that? Or breakups, losing someone that you love, losing a pet. So any event that really takes us out of our normal and our comfort zone in a negative and quick way. And within this scope, of course, there's the clinical traumas that you do need to see a therapist for, first and foremost. I want to be very open and honest. I am not a therapist. I am meant for after therapy or while you're working with the therapist to take what you're learning and practice it in the real world. So again, trauma, what it does is it changes our brain patterns. And so our brain loves patterns. It works off of patterns, and we have pathways, neural pathways, and that is a learned pattern that our brain has. And so when trauma happens, it actually changes those neural pathways. And so then we have a new thought process. We have a new belief in ourselves. It's almost always going to be a negative thought pattern, a negative belief. And what stems from that is those triggers. So either being bullied again, or being around uncomfortable situations, or anything that may remind you of that trauma or that experience that you have is a trigger for those neural pathways. And so it's a new learned behavior that trauma does very instantly. And so when you're working through trauma, it is all about changing those neural pathways. To once again believe in yourself, to once again have confidence in yourself, and to try to limit the impact that those triggers have that would then stem those thought processes or those actions that you take on a normal day to day for after those traumas. And so that's where I really focus. And I find like the brain patterns and the brain functions fascinating. I should have been a neuroscientist, but So that's something that I work on with like my clients and through my Facebook, and here to help give you the tips and advice that you need to start changing some of those neural pathways.
Yeah, that's really amazing. And I know I always talk to people, when I went through trauma and crisis courses in college, I talk about how the most interesting part to me was that you could be thrown into a state of crisis even for a good thing. Any change in your life where, you talked about being laid off, but you can leave a job willingly and you still kind of grieve the loss for the parts of that job that you liked personally. And then trauma, obviously can come at you from so many different ways. And I think I've probably experienced all of the ones that you listed. And because of that, I also do, it's not really life coaching, but peer support, where people that don't have that support system while they're going to therapy, because also not a doctor, but just from going through trauma counseling myself and seeing the importance of that support system. It sounds like that's also very much what you do, where if someone's going through a severe trauma that does require, a licensed mental health professional, you are kind of like their partner through that. And I think that what's interesting that people may not realize is, yes, you can have a great relationship with your therapist, but you're not going to be able to like talk to them as often as you could a life coach or, peer support person. So I think that it's such a really great thing that you're doing. I think that we need more of that in this world because not everyone has that support system, or they may be talking about traumas that they don't want to talk to their family about. That's why they talk to their therapist about it, because, at that point, they're not comfortable talking to everyone in their lives about what's going on.
Yeah, 100%. And
Yeah.
I've going off of that again, we mentioned rabbit holes before starting, and I'm also ADHD, so I love rabbit holes. So when I went through therapy, one thing that I found and kind of what gave me this life purpose is that one, I didn't have the support. So I didn't know how to implement what they were saying. And also, I just didn't feel super comfortable going through a lot of that stuff with them. And so, like, I would take what they were saying and doing it and did it on my own. But then I had to be my own accountability partner. I had to be my own support system. And like you said, that's where we step in and provide that additional support that people need during and after trauma. Because with therapy, it's all about implementation and implementing what they're saying. And therapy isn't meant to be a lifelong journey. You're supposed to, like, from what I've learned, and I'm actually going through my master's for it. So it's supposed to be going in and addressing it and then being able to overcome it. If you have that relationship and you want to continue, that's wonderful. But the whole point is to have them overcome and then go into the real world. And so a lot of times I know some people who have maybe finished that program and then after therapy, they're kind of like, I feel like I've been dumped again. And so kind of more so giving them that soft landing afterwards of the building up that confidence and knowing that they are not alone and that they have a whole community of support outside of therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. I am definitely one of those people where I have continued therapy even when there's nothing to talk about, like where everything's going fine. And I think it's because when these traumatic events happen, trying to find a new therapist and get in with someone is so stressful for me. And it took me 20 years to find a therapist that I like. So I just keep the biweekly appointment with her. And I think also, as I've gone through this journey with Alison in Wonderland, I've been concerned that discussing things may re-traumatize me. And so, like, having that kind of staple there, and it really is like I've always just called it my mental maintenance, where no one has to stay in a relationship with their therapist their whole life. I love mine. And so, in case, the other shoe drops and the next thing happens, and I think that that's just part of trying to, having lived through multiple traumas and finally getting where I have to prepare myself for what the next thing is. So I kind of keep that relationship going as my just in case. It's like my safety blanket.
And that's a really good point. And I don't mean to invalidate that.
Oh,
It
yeah,
is
absolutely.
definitely, if you get that relationship, which for me was so hard, I've been through several therapists. I just
Oh, I
never could get
know.
that relationship. And so if you have that, then yes, of course, like, it's hard to find somebody that you relate with and can feel supportive feel support from them in the way that we need it. So 100%. I don't mean to invalidate that whatsoever.
Oh no, I think I'm the kind of like the exception, not the rule, where people are like, okay, this is a chore, I don't want to keep going through it. And I'm just like, yay, I have therapy. but also just a complete psychology nerd about things. So I think that we both have some lived experience that may help the audience really see where we're coming from on this. So 2013, is that the year you said where you actually died for 33 seconds? Do you want to kind of talk about the domestic abuse relationship you were in and how things got to where they were? Because I think a lot of times people are like, well, I don't know why she just won't leave that person, I don't understand that. But when you're in it, it's not that simple. There's all of these other things. And I think especially when there's physical abuse, there's a lot of mental and psychological abuse that's also being put in there that makes our self-worth, which you were talking about, low enough that we feel like, This is what I deserve. This is the best I can get. So do you want to share a little bit about your lived experience that led you here?
Yeah, 100%. So it was in 2017, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry.
When this happened. And so I started dating my ex-husband in the end of 2014. And in 2014, my dad had actually passed away. So I was grieving my dad, and I will be 100% honest that I just wasn't as present as I should have been. So a lot of these red flags kind of just escaped me because he kind of became my coping mechanism for my dad passing.
Right.
And the best way to describe him is that he was a master manipulator. And when we first started dating, you know, gentlemen, like everything that, you know, anybody would or a woman would want, or and you know, was definitely how do I describe it, like a people pleaser for everyone around us. And we didn't live together at first, of course, obviously, but it wasn't until that, like, we actually moved in together that I started to notice like some of these other things happening, and like comments he would make to me. And you know, he wasn't my first love partner, and so he would actually bring that up as far as like kind of putting me down, like when we would have like arguments, and essentially, you know, calling me a slut of, and so it's like, well, then I would feel guilty of like, well, yeah, I've had other partners before you, but like, and again, like I don't want to give myself excuses, but you know, I was still going through that grieving process, and so it's kind of like I wasn't as defensive as I should have been. I mean, I was already in a very negative space. And so kind of like it fed into that of like, yeah, no, maybe I'm a slut. Like, dang, like, well, I'm sorry I was that way. And it was like a very subtle thing. So it wasn't like it was all of a sudden he was, you know, one way. And, you know, around family and around friends, he was like super doting and loving. But then it was the, like when we're at home and it's just us, like he would say things. And again, I just kind of didn't pick up on it. And it became to a point where, because I was already in negative space and grieving my dad and then hearing more negativity, I just clung to it. And I like changed my beliefs in myself. So like what he was saying, it like, was like, my brain almost like, oh, that makes sense. I am a terrible person. Or, oh man, like I am the problem. Like I need to be better about taking care of the house and need to be better about like all these other things. And so it was kind of a, you know, like putting a frog in cold water and like heating it up. And that's kind of how I use that analogy with our relationship. It very much was that of, it wasn't just all at once. That's true for not just my story, but for a lot of them out there. A lot of these men who are abusers are manipulators. And so they start with, you know, very subtle, like changing in our beliefs. And then it turns into like isolation of, you know, guilt when we want to go hang out with friends, guilt for even having guy friends. And so then we start to become isolated. So we feel like we have no one to go and talk to, except for them. And so then they kind of become our whole world. And so that's kind of the pattern that happened. And that's Like I wasn't allowed to talk to any of my guy friends anymore. And, you know, he made the point of like, that is very disrespectful for to him in our relationship. And so it kind of just progressed in that way. And then it became very mentally and emotionally abusive. Once we got engaged and we're living together, and the things that he would say to me, there was even one time where he could tell that he was kind of losing his control over me, because I was getting to the point of like, you know what, this is too much. Like, I'm over it. Like, I'm going to look for somewhere else to live. And he ended up going, getting his gun and went into the closet and was saying that if I leave, that he's going to commit suicide and it's going to be my fault if I leave. And he's going to like make sure everyone knows that like I was essentially the one that killed him. And so then I felt like, crap, I can't do that. Like, if you're in crisis, like I need to be there for you. And I fully believe he would never have done that. And it was just another control event. And so that's kind of how, unfortunately, it went. And it got to the point where, you know, I would tell my mom like some things, but she wouldn't believe me because
he was so charismatic to everyone else. It doesn't make you feel like it's your fault when everyone in your life thinks that they are such a wonderful person. And I think that's definitely something I've seen through my own relationships, through relationships my mom had. Like, it's very different.
Yeah. And so like when I would bring it up, people wouldn't believe me at all. And he had me go into his church. And I think that was another major actually trauma for me. So like, I actually do have like some religion trauma where I just don't go to church at all anymore. So I grew up Mormon. And so my family is Mormon, and I stopped being Mormon at 18. And that was another thing that he would blame me for, of how I was raised, and that, you know, I'm a bad person for having been a Mormon, and that I need to go and get like religion, and I need to like improve my life. And, you know, at the time, like, again, I was believing all these negative things. I had no confidence anymore. I had like no self-worth. I was like in the point of, you know, this is the best I'm going to get. Like, he treats me really well around other people. And, you know, he's providing, he's paying for the rent, and makes it, you know, easier for me to live. Like, this is the best I'm going to get. And so I started going to church with him, and, you know, that was his community, not my community. And so that, you know, I didn't feel comfortable talking with anybody. And then when I brought it up in like a women's like Bible class, where it was with the pastor's wife, and that was meant to be our counseling, she kind of shut me down really quickly and kind of chastised me for talking about my fiance in that way.
Well, he's the head of the household, and women, and I'm not saying this about all religions, obviously, but there are denominations, there are churches, there are religions where the woman is not the one to speak up, where you do the things that are your wifely duties and the man is in charge of everything. And I think that I'm a religious person, but I also do not have a church that I go to. I feel that, yeah, I guess I can practice my beliefs myself.
Yes. And at this point, I'm more of a spiritual person. Like, my church is going out in nature. I've never felt more calm than in nature. But yeah, so at one point we were doing also like our marriage counseling with them and getting prepared. And we ended up not even having a wedding. Like, he wanted to rush it so bad and have like that control, that we ended up doing like a court marriage. And so, and for me, I'm like, well, you know, I'll get insurance. And that's how he kind of sold it. He's like, you're going to have insurance. Like, you know, I'll take care of you, like all these things. And so I'm like, okay, well, yeah, we'll just get, you know, the wedding and just do this court marriage. And so we did that. And it was after that, with like the church side of things, that they wanted me to do that whole process and get baptized. And I'm like, well, you know, we're married, this is Gobert Church, yeah, I'll get baptized with this church. And so as we were talking, the pastor, it turned into actually a very abusive like conversation between him and my husband, because they were both in there. And then they both started berating me for being Mormon and being raised Mormon, and that I would never be allowed to be a member of that church because of how I was raised.
It's
And
because it's absolutely your fault how your parents raised you. And I do have friends that are former Mormons. I don't know anyone that is currently one, but some of them have had like some gaslighting experiences and things like that. But I don't know enough about it to say like, okay, that was a terrible way to raise your child. I have no idea. But once again, you were a child, you were raised that way. And now you're making like a decision to move to another religion. And they're, you know, saying that you can't be a part of their church because you were raised a certain way.
Yeah. And it was, and that kind of really put me in more, like he had more control over me after that moment. And I did tell him that I didn't want to go back because I, you know, didn't feel comfortable. If I'm not allowed to be there, then I'm not going. And from that moment on, like from us being married and from like that very distinct moment with that pastor as well, he treated me terribly. Like that's when some of the physical things would come into play. It was constantly just mental, emotional abuse and telling me how terrible I am. And it became really hard. And at one point in 2016, I got to the point where like I, you know, told my mom what was happening. She didn't believe me, but she ended up coming and living with us. She's like, if this is really happening, like I want to one, see it and two, prevent it.
Right.
So she came and lived with us for 3 months. And of course he was a complete angel the entire time, everywhere. And it was almost like a reprieve where it's like seeing this man being, again, an angel and doing all these things and doting over me and all of that. It kind of like almost reset where we were at, where I wasn't to a point where like I wanted to leave.
Kind of probably reinforced the thought that it was all in your head. Like this is all you, like.
Yeah, unfortunately kind of did. And so then after she left, it went right back to how it was, of course. And I had, so this is going to sound really weird, but I had a dream from my dad, and he was saying like, you need to leave, like you need to leave. And that was several months after my mom had left. And I just remember in this dream, like he sat me down and like looked at me and was like, you need to leave. And that was like the moment I woke up. I'm like, I'm leaving. Like, yeah, that's it. I packed up my bag.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was like December. I very much remember it. And, you know, my mom and everyone's religious. And so like no one believed in divorce. And so like a lot of that was like the other control side of things. It's like, I didn't feel like I could actually divorce this man now. We're married. But after that, you know, that dream, I told mom, I'm like, dad came from my dream. He told me to leave. I'm leaving. And so she's like, okay, well then I'm coming to you. And she helped, she met me in Atlanta. So at the time I was living in Savannah, Georgia. And, so I packed up my car, picked her up in Atlanta, and then we drove cross country to my hometown in Seattle, Washington. And it was like winter. So we were legit driving through 3 feet of snow. Like that's how determined we were to leave. But then when I got to Washington, no one would house me. So my mom, I had two dogs and they came with me. And my mom wanted to, but her landlord would not allow the dogs. And so he gave me a 2 week period of like, you can stay here for 2 weeks, but then you need to leave. And then my brothers and sisters wouldn't house me because they had kids and they're like, you're a risk to our family and we can't have you here. And so then it turned into this thing of like, well, I have no money because we have a joint account. And so he has the money and I have nowhere to go. And so of course, when he came to Washington, I had nowhere to hide from him. And so went back with him because, I was legit worried that he would do something to my family. So I'm like, well, let me just go back. And so I went back to Savannah with him and a couple months or no, it was the next month I was ended up being pregnant. And that was the scariest moment in that relationship. Cause I was now like, I am stuck with this man. I'm going to be pregnant with, I'm pregnant with this child.
Right.
And it ended up, like, I knew something was wrong though. So like, it was about 2 weeks after I found out that I was pregnant, which he stopped the physical abuse. Like, he stopped trying to tackle me with whenever I would leave or taking my phone. He stopped that. And it became like a whole thing of like, you're having my child and you're going to take care of it. And he was happy. And it was a very like 180 almost. Like, he was still very, you know, emotionally abusive.
It gave him another way to control you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. And, well, I knew something was wrong. I was having pains. I went to my doctor and they said that it was just a UTI. And I brought it up with him of like, something is wrong, I'm having pains. And he wouldn't believe me. And he just said, you know, you're trying to kill my baby. Just knock it off. Like, we're not doing an abortion. I'm like, I'm not trying to do an abortion, but there's something wrong. And no one really believed me. And then, so I woke up. It was a Saturday morning. It was 7:30 exactly on the dot, because I remember looking at the clock and I felt a pop in my abdomen and then just instant excruciating pain, and started screaming. And he told me to shut up. He's like, it's just a UTI, it's not that bad. I'm like, no, something is wrong, we need to go to the ER. And he refused to take me, and told me to take, you know, some Advil. He gave me some, you know, pain meds, and it's like, shut up and go back to bed. There's nothing wrong. I'm like, there is something wrong. He's like, no, you're just trying to kill my child. And that's really like what it came down to. So he refused to take me. I ended up laying back down, trying to go back to sleep and get comfortable again. I couldn't. So I was constantly moaning or yelling in pain because the pain flashes would kind of come and go. And he refused to take me. And it was about 11:30, so it was like 4 hours later, where he was just sick of me making noises. He's like, fine, let's go to the ER and shut you up. Like, I'm going to prove that it's wrong. But he would not even help me to the truck. He wouldn't even help me up into the truck or out of the truck. So I was quite literally crawling to the truck. That's how much pain I was in. I couldn't even like stand up. When we got to the hospital, like, I ended up having to almost like fall out of the truck because he would not help me. And then when we got into the hospital, told him what was going on, and then he joined in and was just like, it's just a UTI, she's being overly dramatic. And that's what he was telling him, and kind of like downplayed what I was experiencing. So we ended up sitting in the ER for 4 hours before they even brought me back. And the entire time I was just like in pain. And it was one of those moments where it's like, why is no one listening to me? Like, I'm telling you what I'm experiencing. We ended up going back into the ER, and I'm lying on, you know, the table. They'd given me morphine, not a whole lot because I was pregnant, so they didn't want to, you know, harm the baby, but I was still in a lot of pain. And I remember that they were joking around about baseball. And, you know, just saying like, oh, women, yeah, you're all women, blah, blah, blah. So,
oh my gosh, I was so bad.
Yeah. And so then I was in the room for about another hour. So I wasn't even taken back to the ultrasound until about 6 o'clock at night. And so I had gotten there at like 12, and they did the ultrasound, and the lady just kind of looked at me and then like ran out of the room. And then, you know, they brought me back to the room, and no nurses were coming in, no doctors were coming in. Finally, the doctor came in like 30 minutes later and was like, well, so you had an ectopic pregnancy that imploded, so we needed to go into emergency surgery.
You were talking about this, I was immediately thinking that it was an ectopic pregnancy. I'm not a medical doctor, and that's exactly what you explained the whole time.
Yep. Yep. And no one believed me, and he wouldn't believe me. And so they brought me back to the operating room, and I ended up bleeding out on the table. So I had internal bleeding this entire time, and bled out and died for 33 seconds on the operating table. All because no one would believe me. They believed him. And I don't say that he was the one that killed me, but if he had listened to me, like, all of this could have been prevented. And I do feel that he and the hospital are to blame for what I went through. but So I died on the operating table. I don't remember the other side. And that's the one thing people always ask, like, oh, do you remember heaven? No, it was just black. But the interesting thing is that I came back a different person. And I don't know if it was, I was just fed up with how I was treated. I don't know what happened on the other side, but I came back a different person. Like, he had zero control over me. And so during that recovery for several months, I knew I'm leaving him and I'm at peace with this now. Like, he has no control over me. He would say things to me and it was like, okay, that's your belief. That's cool. And if I could, I would have left immediately right then and there, but I didn't have any money. And so it was like, I need to get a job. And you start saving money again. And, putting together this plan to exit the relationship in a way where I'm not just homeless. And so that's what I did. And obviously having dogs puts, a little wrench into everything because not everywhere accepts dogs. And
right.
So I spent the next essentially year saving money and putting together my plan to leave. He had no control over me. So he didn't do anything physical. And it was kind of like, because he had no control over me, he also was losing interest in me. And so it was an interesting period of time where it's neither of us really had interest in each other. And it was, I don't want to say it was peaceful, but it wasn't as abusive as it was because he knew that he tried to play all the cards that he had over and over again. And then I'm just no, we're not having sex. We're not having another baby. We're not doing all of this stuff. I'm done. And so I left in 2018 and, that's when I started my journey for, going through trauma therapy. I looked into alternatives because I am never one to be just comfortable talking in a room to somebody. Like, I always feel awkward. I'm very much ADHD as well. So then my attention kind of goes everywhere. So I looked into how can I help other women? And so, I knew that in order to help other people, I needed to fully heal myself. And so I looked into getting back into artwork. So I have always loved drawing. That's always been a passion of mine. My parents actually paid for me to have an art docent when I was young because I had a lot of talent and they wanted me to grow that. And this relationship actually had me not doing any artwork. And so I got back into that and artwork became very therapeutic. I was actually able to get out a lot of the emotions I was feeling through my art pieces. And then and also ended up going back into horses as well. So I leased a horse and that was a powerful moment. And I actually started recently a nonprofit where we're a horse rescue that provides free equine therapy services to veterans, and I'm working right now to get partnerships to open it up to domestic abuse survivors as well. But that became my healing tools of, art and horses, and then, also taking those therapy steps that we need to. And so I got my certification in health coaching. I was a health coach for several years, and I'm actually still a health coach manager now. And then I got my therapeutic art life coaching certification. So that way I can bring in and utilize the things that helped me and what helped me through that period of time to help others as well.
Wow. That it's unfortunate that the story sounds so familiar to people that I've talked to. And that's what's really terrible is I imagine there are some people that are listening to this going, I can't imagine this would happen. I don't understand. And then in my mind, I'm thinking, and I went through this and my mom went through this. I think that the threat of suicide is very difficult. From 17 to 18, I did date someone that that had previously tried to take his own life. And throughout the entire relationship, it was if I left, he was going to kill himself and that it would be my fault. And it completely ruined my relationship with half of my family. Like, moved out of my dad's to move into my mom's because he had a warrant for him in the city that my dad lived in. So we moved into my mom's house because I was 17 at that time. I turned 18 while we were together. And there was this time when my mom was out of town and I did finally just decide that we were going to break up. And the next thing I know, and I don't even know how this happened, like we're on the ground and he's choking me. And at first I did not even like, it didn't feel real. Like it felt like he was joking or something. And then all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, he's going to kill me. Like he's going to kill me. Like I did not realize that like when he meant he was going to kill himself, if I left him, that there was also this, but first I'm going to kill you moment. And I was like 95 pounds. I was so tiny. And I like punched him in the side of the head and like somehow got out from under him and like chased him down the road, like screaming at him. He did end up going to jail for a little while, showed back up at my mom's when he got out. Like, luckily, I had like all these cousins in the Air Force that were all sitting on the front porch the day he showed up. And I didn't even know he was there until he had gotten his travel papers, whatever that you call it.
Yeah.
The really terrible part is my mom's reaction was everybody has their Robbie. So when I was young, in between stepdad number two and stepdad number three, my mom dated this guy named Robbie. And I remember being very young and us going into hiding for 2 weeks and missing school. And her being all bruised and stuff. And when I was older, I found out it was that he had proposed and she had said no, and he just beat her like within an inch of her life, like a lot of internal bleeding, a lot into her stomach. But like her thought process was, well, everyone has their Robbie. Everyone goes through this abusive relationship. And I was talking to someone about this the other day, and I was like, that's really messed up. Like, it's really messed up that that was the response that I got. Mm-hmm. So like the, like, No, we don't have to all have that person. That does not have to be a woman's journey to end up in like an actual healthy relationship. But then also like, I was so very young at the time, and I really did not think, I guess I never realized that the emotional threats that he was tying me to would become physical. Like I was just so shocked. It's like literally laying on the ground, being choked, took me time to realize that he was trying to kill me. Like you would think that you would immediately think that, but it's just, it's really terrible that so many women go through this. And then also just the public face that, you know, the abuser can put on, where it makes you sound like you're lying, or they alienate you from your family because they're all lying and they're all terrible people. And look at how they've treated you. I'm the only one that actually takes care of you. It's just such a terrible cycle that so many people, and I keep saying women, I'm not saying only women can be abused or go through trauma, but just my personal lived experience. I've never been a man, so I don't have personal lived experience as a man. So, I mean, like there's so much there's so much about, the whole journey and how it just escalated. And I think that if people could really understand how things escalate so gradually and how they can be, you know, a master manipulator and super charismatic and then a completely different person to other people, then maybe there wouldn't be the stigma of like, well, why did she stay? If this was happening, why did she stay? Because like, there was like literally nowhere for you to go. Like where, like your mom came and got you, but then you couldn't stay with her. Your family's very religious. So I'm guessing the you not being good for their family was the fact that you had left your husband and you were probably in an emotional state. And so they didn't want that around their children. That's what I took away from that. Part of it is that kind of the feeling that you were getting as well.
Partially. So for one of my siblings, yes. It and like my nieces and nephews from her have called me a bad person before. but it was also just not just like my beliefs and who I am. So like for my other siblings, it wasn't who I am. It was the fact that they knew that he was going to come and they didn't want him around their kids. Like if he was to come and like it turned into an altercation, they didn't want to be involved.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And I think that even then at that point They're worried that he's going to come and get you and they're in danger, but they also let him take you home with him. Like, it's so backwards. Like, it's really commendable that you were able to, you know, wake up and be like, okay, I'm going to come up with a plan and I'm going to get out of this. And then not only just like immediately dive into, you know, helping your own trauma, but then how am I going to help other women in the future going through with this? And I think that that's just really, it's just this piece that, you know, obviously I'm not saying that women that have been abused are terrible people if they don't go use that experience to help other people. Absolutely not. Everybody doesn't have to be as open as about their experience. It's just, that's what's right for you, and telling your story is, you know, how you help other people. So I never want anybody to think that I'm saying, because you're doing this and it's a great thing, that them not doing it is a bad thing. Absolutely not. Some of us like cannot re-traumatize ourselves over and over again. And that's definitely, it's interesting. And I know that we had a few other things that we really wanted to go over. And so I'd like to briefly touch on the affirmations. And then I'd like to really just have like a whole other episode with you about that, if that's okay with you, because I feel like we can briefly touch on it now and then follow up, because I have a feeling that when we're talking about, you know, the affirmations and the habits and kind of rewiring your brain, that that's a whole other, like, okay, now we have the story. How can we maybe fix this or help people going forward, if that's okay with you?
Yeah, 100%. It definitely requires a lot. And I actually have a free exercise I'd be happy to send to you to give to your listeners as well. So that way, you know, they can build up those affirmations, and as well as, you know, going through some of those mindset and belief changes. There's a lot of different art exercises I love doing. And so again, art is one of my modes, not that everyone has to do that, but it's a great way to really visualize and to build those affirmations for sure.
Yeah, that's great. And I will definitely, I'll connect the link. We will schedule another call to follow up very quickly, I think, as just a whole episode about the affirmations, because I think that it's something we want to really get into, but I think it's really powerful for everyone to hear what led you there and the story and the background on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. And one thing I do want to say is that, you know, trauma is different for everybody. And so I don't want people to hear my trauma and think, oh, my trauma wasn't that bad, like, and belittle what they experienced, or vice versa. And we're all different beings. And I don't want to say that we can handle different things, because that's messed up to say, but that, you know, we experience different things in different ways. And so do not belittle what you experienced or belittle what other people have experienced, and that, you know, what happens and psychologically what happens to all of us is very unique. And for example, like, you and I may have gone through something very, like, exactly the same for example, and we might come out the other side seeing something different. And so that's something I definitely want to put out there, of like, you know, don't hear my trauma or anyone else's trauma and belittle yourself.
I absolutely agree. I always think about it like a fingerprint. Did your dog just shut the door?
No, my fiance. He just got home.
Okay, that's gonna be funny on the tape, but you know, there's always random pet stuff going on. So I always think about it like a fingerprint. Like, you know, the fingerprints are so unique. And so if you think about your personality and your experiences and things that have made you the person that you are, it's as unique as your fingerprint, which means if we do go through the exact same things, we're still not going to have the same fingerprint. So I think that that's, it's a really important thing to mention. I agree. I mean, my journey started when I lost my brother as a result of suicide. That does not mean that if I met someone else that lost their brother as a result of suicide, that our journey was the same. Because our relationships, our childhood, things like that were very different. I really appreciate you going so in depth about your experiences. And I am so excited to have you back on and let's talk about the affirmations, because I'm really interested in that as well. And I'll make sure that everything's linked. So thank you so much for joining Allison in Wonderland. I think if the listeners knew how many things on my list I had that I wanted to talk about that we haven't gotten to, they'll understand why we're going to break this down into a couple of episodes.
I love the rabbit holes. I love rabbit holes. So
absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. And I really look forward to the next time that we speak.
Looking forward to it.